Welcome to a very special edition of Wampum.Codes. This is kind of a supergroup episode where we went ahead and made a Zoom panel with all of the previous guests of Wampum.Codes, hosted by the MIT Co-Creation Studio and the OpenDoc Lab. It was going to be a live panel that we did as part of the Indigenous Digital Delegation at MIT that has been postponed to the fall, and we decided to go ahead and host this panel anyways on Zoom, and we recorded it, and I'm going to share that with you right now in a special edition of Wampum.Codes.
Hello, and welcome to the MIT Open Documentary Lecture Series. I know there's a lot of new people. My name is Sarah Wallison, and I am the director of the MIT Open Documentary Lab. This is a series that normally we have in the lab, but because we're all home now, we've brought it online. But we found it worked really well, and it allows many more people to participate. So if you're interested in future talks, you can go online to our website and sign up. Today, we're thrilled to have Amelia Winger Bearskin and a panel of Indigenous artists, technologists, and knowledge keepers. The name of our panel is Indigenous Tech, Indigenous Knowledge, Wampum.Codes, as a model for decolonization. This is brought to you from the Co-Creation Studio, and Kat Cizek, the artistic director, is going to say a few words. So thank you.
Hey, thanks, Sarah, so much. Today, we just wanted to, first of all, welcome all of you from across the continent and perhaps the world to join us in virtually acknowledging Indigenous land and territory from all of your locations. Claudia Romano, our producer, is going to drop in the chat a list of land acknowledgements, and we invite you to put one in from where you are today as well. MIT is situated on the traditional unceded territory of the Wampanoag Nation, and today we particularly express concern that earlier this month, in the middle of the COVID-19 outbreak on the reservation, the Trump administration revoked the reservation status of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe in Massachusetts. At the Co-Creation Studio this year, we're honored to host Mozilla Open Web Fellow Amelia Winger Bearskin, who is Seneca Cayuga Nation of Oklahoma Haudenosaunee from Deer Clan. And today's panel is part of a virtualization of a three-day Indigenous media and digital delegation that we were supposed to host on campus right now, this week, in partnership with the Indigenous Screen Office based in Canada. The theme of the delegation is Indigenous Knowledge, Artificial Intelligence, and Digital Worlds. And I really want to thank Carrie Swanson and Julie Nagam, heads of the delegation. We're honored to have them join us today, along with several other members of the delegation, to join us in the last half of this panel as respondents. Just a reminder to you all that the chat box in the bottom of the Zoom interface is here for discussions and links and all that kind of stuff. But if you have a question for the panel, please put it in the Q&A section of the webinar interface at the bottom. And Claudia will bring those to the panelists later on. Today's panel is part of Wampum.Codes. It's Amelia's Mozilla Fellowship project, and it's my pleasure to introduce Amelia, who's an artist and technologist. Last year, she presented to His Holiness Dalai Lama's world headquarters in Dharamsala for the Summit on Fostering Universal Ethics and Compassion. In 2018, she was awarded a MacArthur and Sundance Institute Fellowship for her 360 video immersive installation in collaboration with the artist Wendy Redstar. She founded, in partnership with the New Rochelle Mayor's Office, Idea New Rochelle, which won the 2018 $1 million Bloomberg Mayor's Challenge for their VR/AR Citizen Toolkit to help the community co-design their city. She also advises the Sundance Institute for the New Frontiers Story Lab and their festival, and is a developer evangelist for Contentful. It's really my honor to hand this over to Amelia, who's going to open us up, I think, with the theme song of the Wampum.Codes podcasts. Over to you.
Right. Thank you so much, Kat. I'm so excited to be here. And every episode of Wampum.Codes, we usually have a very dumb theme song that I play on my flute, and I thought I'd play it with for you live. Thank you. You're missing the chimes, but usually I have really ridiculous chimes on that too. Thank you so much and welcome to this amazing panel and to my incredible human beings that are here with us today. I created Wampum.Codes, the podcast, because I wanted to make a podcast that sounded like sitting in an amazing dinner party like we often do at Sundance or Gathering of Nations or another such a place where amazing Indigenous people gather. And I listen to incredible things that people are doing. And I wanted to just keep that feeling going all month long. But then when our pandemic hit, it was the thing that really kept me sane. And I didn't want us to have to dumb anything down or speak to anyone but each other, which in turn makes the podcast feel relatable to people who are not technologists or artists or even Indigenous, and it keeps it real, which means our style is conversational, our pathway is windy, and our hearts are right there on our sleeves. So now I would like to introduce the incredible panelists that that we have here with us today. I have with me Indigenous technologists, some who I've met this year, some more than 30 years ago. Each has made positive impacts on their communities in rich and diverse ways. While I have spent over an hour speaking on the podcast with each of you, where people can learn a lot more about your background. So please, if you are interested, go and listen to Wampum.Codes and you can hear a lot more in depth about each one of these panelists. So I'm going to give a short intro, just brief highlights about each of them. And then in their own voice, they're going to talk about their own tribal affiliations, and they may have greetings, they may speak in their own language, so that will happen after I do these brief introductions. And when I say your name, would it be okay if you either like wave or like dab? It's just your choice, because you know, dabbing, I feel like it's the new sincerity. So, I have alphabetically in English. I guess we can move to our lovely gallery view now so we can see everybody wave when I introduce you. Alphabetically in English, we have Asha Veeraswamy, is a hybrid creative practitioner specializing in virtual, augmented, and mixed reality, XR, with an emphasis on multi-user, social, and collective experiences. Her work fuses art, design, and technologies such as motion capture, game engines, and animation to develop scalable immersion. Next, we have Dawn Borchardt, is a photographer and filmmaker with 15 plus years of experience. She has worked in the operations and programming departments for film festivals such as Sundance, LA Film Festival, Montclair Film Fest, and many more. Most recently, she was the festival producer for the Freeland Film Festival in Wisconsin, which shares stories that inspire focusing on endangered environments and wildlife that are fighting to make a comeback. Next, we have Desalyn Rue George Warren, who is a queer artist, researcher, and organizer whose work ranges from performance to installation art, to community education, to food sovereignty, to language revitalization. Since 2017, he has been the special projects coordinator for the Catawba Cultural Preservation Project, where he facilitates the Catawba Language Project, several food sovereignty initiatives, and other community education projects. In 2018, Desalyn was recognized as a 2018 40 Under 40 by the National Council in American Indian Enterprise Development. Next, we have Erica Tremblay, is an award-winning filmmaker and digital strategist with over 10 years experience across interactive and video content. Her projects have been screened at 60 plus film festivals, and her work has been featured on PBS, CNN, and IFC. She was recently honored as a 40 Under 40 Native American and was a 2018 Sundance Native Film Lab Fellow. Erica is currently studying her Indigenous language, and her short film Little Chief had its world premiere at Sundance Film Festival in 2020. Next, we have Eve Lauren LaFontaine, and she's a Los Angeles-based multimedia artist and educator. Her work explores identity, history, Indigenous futurism, feminism, ghosts, magic, and her mixed Native American and Jewish heritage through lens-based media and installations. She's a Sundance New Frontier and Indigenous MacArthur Fellow, and has received support for her work from the Mike Kelly Foundation, the Andy Warhol Foundation, and was an interactive storyteller for Tribeca Film Institute. Next, we have Jade Begay, who leads the Endian Collective's multimedia content development through strategic narrative development and creative content design. Begay has extensive experience as a multimedia producer, filmmaker, and communications professional, working in nonprofit and Indigenous organizations. She has a bachelor's degree in film and video and a master's of arts degree in environmental leadership. That's a really cool name for a degree. Next, we have Joseph Cliff, who is wearing an incredible suit made entirely of cat faces. And I'm so happy that he's here wearing that suit. He is a comedy writer, performer based out of Los Angeles. His writing credits include Wabbit and Lego Ninjago, Decoded for Cartoon Network, OMG and Swamp Talk with Shrek and Donkey for DreamWorks, and Nerdist News with Jessica Chobot for Nerdist, among other shows. He also has a web series episode he co-wrote for the Fine Brothers that was nominated for a 2017 Streamy Award in the immersive category. Most importantly, he is the admin of the LA Underground Cat Network, an 8,000 member strong Facebook group for Los Angeles comedians to share pictures of their cats. He's kind of a cat guy. Next, we have Martha Winger Bearskin, a computer scientist in applied topographic research under the National Geospatial Technology Operations Center at the United States Geological Survey. She's the only real computer scientist on our panel, and she talks to more actual legitimate scientists than the rest of us nerds. She and I have the same last name because we have the same mother and the same father. Genes are funny that way. Her child looks like me, my son looks like her, it's a whole thing. Next, we have Morningstar Angeline. In 2014, she made her feature debut as Nishoni Smiles in Drunk Town's Finest at the Sundance Film Festival. Since then, Angeline has starred in Paramount's Yellowstone, Netflix's Chambers, and HBO's upcoming series, This Much I Know Is True. Behind the camera, she has assisted producers and directors, including Zack Snyder and Steve Felder. Angeline has received awards from the American Indian Film Festival, also the Institute of American Indian Arts, New Mexico Film, and the TV Hall of Fame, and is the 2018 Sundance Indigenous Lab Fellow for her directorial debut, Ya'ate'e Abini. Many of you know, I get giddy, because she's also the voice in Red Dead Redemption 2 of the local pedestrian population. This just makes me really excited because I'm a gamer. Each of you are many more than these short bios, and while all of you are Indigenous, some of you have special ways to present your tribal affiliations. So I'm going to go around the little Zoom and say our tribal affiliations. I am Seneca Cayuga Nation of Oklahoma, and there are so many Senecas on this Zoom, which is awesome. All right, and I will just, should I call out your name or just jump forward? You got it.
Me? I am a first-generation descendant of the Menominee Nation in northern Wisconsin.
I'm Morningstar Angeline. I'm Dene, Shoshone, Chippewa, Cree, Blackfeet, and Latina.
Nake, Nyat, Leslin, George Warren, Nyat, Ni, Tempru, Yaksana, Wanda, George Warren, Tetewana, Buck, George, Yang Iswaare, Yang Katabare, Yang Company, Sawachahare. Hi, everyone. My name is Leslin George Warren, but I go by Roo, like kangaroo, since I was a fetus. So feel free to call me that. And I'm a citizen of Catawba Nation. We are the people of the river, because we've been living along the Catawba River since the world began. And that's what my digital backdrop is a view of our beautiful river, which I can actually see from my window about 1,000 feet away. So happy to be here.
My name is Joey Clift. I'm in rural Cowlitz. Our Aboriginal land is like southern Washington State, kind of around Mount St. Helens. And I would say hello in my Cowlitz language, but my Cowlitz dictionary is like 40 feet that way, and I've got headphones in. But I assure you, our language is wonderful.
Scano Swaguego, Ondalaya Stuntni Gyaso, Gayokono Niwa Quinzo De, De Wahondas Niwa Geshout De. My name is Ondalayesta, or Erica Tremblay. I am from the Seneca Cayuga Nation of Oklahoma, and I am joining you today from my ancestral land near Cayuga Lake in Ithaca.
Yette Binet, my name is Jade Begay. I am calling from my ancestral land in Tasuka, New Mexico. I am Tasuka Pueblo, Diné, and Southern Ute. And I'm so happy to be here.
Someone else, sorry.
Martha, I think you're muted.
Sorry. Oh, thank you. Okay.
That's okay.
Got to give it myself. Martha Fairskin. I'm also from the Seneca Cayuga Nation of Oklahoma. We are also the Wyandot as well, which Amelia forgot to mention.
Aren't we all? I mean, like,
We are, our ancestral land is of course in upstate New York. I currently reside in St. Louis, so I'm somewhat closer to our reservation out in Oklahoma. We get to kind of drive through there sometimes. So that's me.
Buju, hi, I'm Eve, the fountain or turtle spirit woman. I come from the Turtle Mountain Chippewa people in North Dakota. I'm also Jewish, as Amelia mentioned, a Southern Jew. I'm coming from you, or coming from today, the ancestral lands of the Tongva people in Los Angeles, in Echo Park. And it's also where my family was relocated in the 1950s through the Relocation Act. But I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, with a lot of other wonderful people, kind of world of Native artists, come from a family of Native artists, proudly representing that next generation of artists who are doing interesting work. And thank you, Amelia McGuich. Thanks for having us.
My name is Asha Viraswamy, and I'm an enrolled member of the Seneca Nation of Indians, which is a sovereign nation located in upstate New York.
So many Senecas. Jade, do you want to go next?
Oh, I went.
Oh, you went. That's right. I'm losing my mind now. Anyone else not go? We're good. Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing each of your amazing welcomes. I have my first question to my group of panel. Each of you have different ways in which you use technology in your work and to help your community. While I myself can list a lot of things wrong with tech culture, or the internet in general, what are some inspiring ways that you've used technology to create something beautiful or to foster a beautiful connection with your own community? And this is a question for any of you, and I would love to just for you to jump in popcorn style, should you be moved to.
I'll start. it's hard to say because I feel like I might take it back immediately, but I kind of want to say most of the work that I do is married to technology, and I can't really separate it. So any and all work that I do within film or music or even writing, I feel like we kind of put ourselves in a corner where I can't, handwriting and things like that, like technology, because we're all working remotely, which is great. But even pre-quarantine, that was the way we did things. So I think technology helps us create and share and collaborate, but also, I found it to be a great resource for crowdfunding or connecting to an audience and things like that, that I wouldn't normally, especially Indigenous cinema, normally have. So that's been really great.
Awesome.
I think for me, like a lot of how, I'm Cowlitz, which is based out of Southern Washington, but I'm currently living on Tongva territory, which is SoCal. So like my involvement with my tribe is pretty much only through technology. And the way that tends to manifest itself is like, I feel like a lot of my job being a Native American person in the entertainment industry is just like spreading awareness that we exist and are real people and don't have magic powers. All that good stuff.
I mean, some of us have magic powers.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's like, we like to keep those secret. Like we can't let people know about our shapeshift abilities. But, you know, I think that the way that I try to manifest that in, you know, creativity is like, I try to like, I guess like wear my nativeness on my sleeve. Like I oftentimes put my tribal affiliation on bios and stuff like that. I definitely try to use my position to kind of just, you know, make sure that there's like a native voice in the room for projects and things like that. And, you know, I also try to, you know, just wave my native flag as much as possible whenever I'm on, you know, podcasts or anything like that. Just because, you know, I think that like, because we're, you know, quote unquote, invisible minority oftentimes in the media, it's just like, I'm trying to use my position to like boost other natives up and then also try to make us more visible, you know?
And have you found any specific types of technologies that have sort of helped? Or I mean, Joey, you use a lot of social media. I feel like you're very adept at Twitter and keeping yourself out there. Is there any other spaces that others have found vital or vibrant? Or maybe, Joey, even talk about how you engage with other Indigenous people on Twitter, because you've done a really great job at gathering us together on that space.
Oh, yeah. So a direct example of how I've kind of tried to just boost other Native voices up is there's a famous stand-up comedian named Tig Notaro, who she's one of those people she has like a show on Netflix and Hulu, and she's super funny and a really nice person. She's done a comedy bit on Twitter for the past couple of years where she's just let every 24 hours a different comedian take over her Twitter account. And I think it was like late last year, early this year, she just tweeted something to the effect of, hey, you know, like I'm thinking of maybe changing this up, doing theme months or something like that. And I just tweeted at her saying something to the effect of like, hey, it would be cool if you gave natives access to your account. And her assistant, Patrick McDonald, a really nice guy, super funny comedian, reached out and said, I agree, that's a good idea. So he asked me to put together a list of like 23 just, you know, really great Native comedians, actors, creatives, activists, and stuff like that. And I spent a good chunk of time doing that. That's Amelia was one of the people who did it. She was great. And we just basically took over Tig's Twitter account last month. And, you know, I think that's me trying to use my position to just like, you know, it's like so much of it is just like putting us in people's timelines and in kind of non-native spaces that people don't often like look for native stuff. So, you know, that's an example of it. And then it's also just like, I think that we're in a very DIY spot right now in terms of content creation. You know, you could shoot a video on your cell phone or, you know, on your computer. So you don't necessarily need, like a television network to give you permission to kind of get your message out there. So, you know, for me, it's like also just guesting on podcasts and, you know, speaking about Native issues, kind of like weaving that stuff in here and there. And I think that those DIY places, kind of in terms of technology, are basically giving us a voice that's causing mainstream people to pay attention to us. So it's like, it's, you know, 5 years ago, it was tough to like go into a room and pitch a Native project. But if a bunch of natives show up on podcasts and talk about like kind of, you know, just how interesting we are as people and our stories and stuff like that, and like cool Hollywood executives listen to those podcasts, then we kind of like basically like hack into them of just like, oh, native stuff's interesting. So, you know, it's basically using the DIY aesthetic of social media to boost us up and tell people that our voices should be heard, you know?
That's awesome. That's really great. Has anyone else done any similar interesting? I mean, social media, I have like a very love-hate relationship with it. Mostly it hates me, but I love it. But, you know, like I would love to know if anyone else has kind of found a space or maybe, you know, found something that they are like, I don't like that.
I'll jump in. I think that, I think I battled this for a long time and still do. And I think a lot of Indigenous people do, and certainly non-Indigenous people do, where all of the representation that we've seen of ourselves is really kind of stuck in this time capsule. And we see ourselves reflected back, you know, wearing certain clothing or whatnot. But the reality is that we're modern people that exist right now. And I think that it took me a while to really accept technology as a way that I could be a storyteller. But what's traditional for me as a Seneca Cayuga woman is telling stories, not necessarily telling them around a fire in the longhouse, which is like great to know that that's where we came from, but also to like accept the fact that we are modern people that have access and are or, you know, should have access to modern ways to tell stories. And so that includes, you know, cameras and our cell phones and figuring out how to navigate social media. And, you know, when I started using my camera as a tool and taking it more seriously as an extension of my voice and using medicines with it and, you know, really realizing that it was an extension of the stories that I wanted to tell and not this kind of like scary piece of technology that I should be scared of touching my stories, I think that was like a real breakthrough moment for me. And, you know, I'm currently working on a project about missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so for me, I'm very careful to take care of that camera after exiting each interview, you know, after speaking to a faith keeper in my longhouse and got a guidance on how to treat that piece of machinery as you would other things as you are conversing with people who are sharing, you know, powerful stories. And I think that it took me a while to be like, oh, this camera, these things that, you know, I plug in and charge up and take with me, are a modern way for me to extend, you know, my stories and the stories of the folks that I'm documenting.
That's really awesome.
Yeah, everyone's bringing up a lot of super interesting things. I, just to give a background on how I got into kind of the technology sphere, of course, I was created in the fires of MySpace HTML and CSS development. In the era when GIFs were sparkly angels. And then off and on, like during school breaks, I would dabble in various web technologies. But then in 2017, I was living in DC and received a grant from Running Strong for American Indian Youth to come back to my community and work on our language project, specifically to develop web technologies. And I kind of BS'd in the application. I was like, yeah, I can totally do this. And then I was like, oh my gosh, like this is kind of daunting. So I dove into mostly JavaScript development. And kind of the first thing was I was talking to our language keeper, my mentor, Becky Garris. And I was like, what can we address immediately? And she was like, well, it's impossible to type Catawba on computers. And I was like, okay, we'll do a keyboard. And from there, we've developed our Catawba language project, catawbalanguage.org, where we have resources for people to learn the language. And probably the most exciting part, kind of going back to Amelia's original question, was our partnership with our tribal Head Start program. They really wanted to develop word lists that they would teach kids and families throughout the year. And so we developed an online resource where they and their families can go and hear the words and see the words. And what's great now is that sometimes those kids stump me with the language, and that to me feels like the best kind of situation to be in. But thinking back to social media and what that was bringing up is, you know, moving back to rural South Carolina as a queer person was difficult to say the least, but social media has kind of alleviated some of that pressure and allowed me to stay connected with queer folks from all across the world, really, which feels like a lifeline a lot of the time here, because we only have one gay bar in the county. And if you look it up, the first thing that comes up is local man shot dead at gay bar on New Year's Eve. So not necessarily the place I'm trying to hang out. I think there was something else I was gonna say. Oh, and the other thing that I'm particularly into right at this moment about technology is that this technology has existed for a while for us to be able to do these sorts of webinars online. And I've been thinking a lot recently as someone who gets flown to places to talk. Like, I was just up in New York speaking at a university right before COVID happened, and they flew me up, paid me an honorarium, put me in a hotel, and then I spoke for a total of maybe 20 minutes. I was on a panel, and I was just thinking, you know, this is not environmentally sustainable. Like, this is not how we can continue moving forward if we want people, interesting people, to come and talk in spaces. So I'm hoping that maybe an outcome of this is we take a brief break from Zoom, because I think we're all going to need it, and then we readdress, like, maybe you don't need to fly me up somewhere for me to be able to talk to you. So those are kind of the things that are at the forefront of my mind right now.
Absolutely. I think we can all feel the Zoom fatigue, and I'm able to speak to so many of my friends and colleagues without getting on a plane. I don't miss that, although I will like to get on a plane again someday. I have a second question. How do we take the values of our Indigenous communities and apply them to projects in tech that can help our world? And Martha, since your job is to keep scientific data open and free to all, regardless of the ability to profit, data that could help us protect our precious earth and our natural resources, and to understand the mysteries of the world that we have, all around us. I would love to know your thoughts, and also how do you maintain something so large and important as an open source data set of our planet? And also unmute yourself.
There we go. Yeah, so I work for the United States Geological Survey. I work a lot in data collection and data management. And I think one of the things, I think it's really, really important to keep that information public and accessible to everyone. I think there's a lot of talk about companies being able to do things more efficiently than the government, which, yes, I'll say yes, faster. But then I think we're compromising this data that I believe, especially data about our land and our country, this is our data as people. I believe that this data belongs to us. We are the ones that are, our taxpayer dollars are paying for this data. And so I believe that it belongs to us and that it shouldn't belong to a company, so that it can be used for everything from a college student doing a research project to a scientist, kind of all over can use this information. It should be free and accessible to everyone. I think that's just really, really important. And I think as a Native person, it's really interesting. This field was not something I got into. I was computer science. I didn't even know what GIS was, which is geospatial information system. I had no idea of it. But I think it's interesting as a Native person that I have, taken on this career of caretaker of the land. And that really has inspired me and pushes me to kind of continue doing this public servant work.
So a lot of us here, I'm sure, have worked a lot with open source code, because that's how a lot of us start. And so maybe maybe Asha and Rue, and anyone else that works, a lot with code and the type of projects, If you can give any advice to people who are also either accessing and working with open source projects or starting and maintaining them themselves, whether it's user information or ways in which you maybe teach your students how to interact with them, or just tips to all of us out there who are developing open source projects and want to make sure that they can be the most accessible and beautiful and fun that we can make them.
So to respond to your question, I think one of the Indigenous values that I hold very dear is that of community, right? And being proactive in whatever community you're a part of, whether that's your Indigenous community, whether that's the tech community, whether that's your arts community. And when you talk about community and creating things in a community-oriented fashion, you start thinking about collective experiences and this idea of co-creation, right? And so at the MIT Co-Creation Studio, from what I understand, they're identifying four different types of needs for co-creation, right? Within communities, within in-person and online, across disciplines and organizations, and how do humans co-create with new forms of data and new forms of intelligence like AI? So I think part of this is acknowledging that you can be a creator in content, but the act of co-creating can be much more powerful. And that's the question that I lead to all of you, is how do you become a proponent of co-creation? And to end with that, I think that leading and developing and building on open source software and code is a great way of doing that, because you have a solid foundation base and you're able to take bits and pieces of what works and then co-create and remix to fulfill your need or the needs of your community. And I also think that, part of the reason why this pandemic has hit all of us very hard is because we've been forced to quarantine ourselves. So I would like to hear more from all of you, is what are some of the solutions that you guys have found within co-creation?
Those are wonderful questions.
Yeah. going to Amelia's question, for me, it was because of open source technologies was the only reason I was able to get into programming. I have kind of two experiences with specific kinds of technology. One is DAW or music programming softwares, and this more open source JavaScript area. And the barrier to entry into a lot of music recording software is super high because the price tag is super high. For JavaScript, it was like I had my $400 computer and access to GitHub, and I was able to, and YouTube, and learned from some really amazing people through that. And through that, I was able to, at almost no cost, get into these technologies. Going to Ash's question, I spend a lot of my time with plants. I spent this morning, I'm going to blame my disheveledness on spending this morning planting corn. So for me, it's in this moment, kind of turning away from in-person human connections and thinking about connections and collaborations with other than human beings in our landscape. The last thing I was going to say is one thing that I think some of the metaphors and language we use around technology hides is the physical aspect of the internet and virtual space and digital realities. I mean, we talk about the cloud as if this data is somewhere up there, but in reality, it's using energy, a lot of that produced from fossil fuels. These the pipelines that literally carry the internet are entering and exiting our lands, are disrupting coastlines. So I would love for us to figure out some collaborative language making around how we can actually talk about what the internet is. I mean, we're talking about Zoom, and one of the practices, a group I'm working with called Unsettling Dramaturgy, we're a group of Indigenous and Crip theater makers from across so-called US and so-called Canada. And one practice that we use is we do a Zoom acknowledgement and talk about where Zoom is located, what are some of the infrastructures that it uses, and recognizing that in this digital space, we're actually having the impact on physical spaces as well.
I can jump into your question too. So I produce the Freeland Film Festival, which is based in central Wisconsin, and it is created with having a pretty significant space in the festival for Native storytelling, song, dance. It's really a place to bring the community together, both Native and non-Native. But obviously, with the current situation, we are trying to grapple with whether or not to host the festival at a later date, do it digitally. So those are conversations we're having right now. And it's a difficult one to have because the feeling of community in person is so important, and like being able to like dance together and things like that. So we're trying to weigh, is it still effective enough online right now? And I don't know. I mean, that's kind of like the situation we're all obviously in. And right now, at this moment, we have no choice. But it's interesting to think about like how effective community is digitally versus in person.
I'm being a comedy writer in Los Angeles. So much of what I do is by nature of it collaborative. And I'm sure Eric speaks this in terms of filmmaking, and that it's like, it's tough to make a film without, you know, a camera, directors, actors, writers, and most of those people need to be in the same room for the thing to get made. And because of that, writers' rooms for shows are largely right now switching to Zoom, kind of the ones that are staying open. And then the shows that are live action, like I was writing on a show kind of before the quarantine and then a little bit into the quarantine. And it was kind of a daily talk show. And I very clearly remember the moment where we switched from, oh, all of the bits that we're writing are in studio with guests to, okay, all of the bits that we're writing are shot in the host's house using his webcam. So, you know, I think that it's causing us to be very adaptable when it kind of comes to how that stuff goes as far as in-person stuff goes. And then of course, in-person meetings are now over the phone or over Zoom or whatever. It's just, it's a collaborative industry. So we're just kind of figuring out what works for us right now. And then, fingers crossed, stuff goes back to normal so we can film stuff again.
I'll jump in to explain a different kind of filmmaking process that I've just been a part of. And also just to acknowledge that I think collaborative making is a very Indigenous way of making things and experiencing the world, just making sure that your community is involved in general. So it's just a different approach even to creating work. I've been involved at the Echo Park Film Center here in Los Angeles for many years, over 10 years. And we actually just created a new film together in quarantine all over the world. So it's intercontinental. We do a really radically different kind of filmmaking than the mainstream industry that's here, where we really focus on kind of small format filmmaking, 16 millimeter Super 8, but also just like empowering mostly young people to use the tools that they have around them, like phones, or like little flip cams and stuff like that, to go and make a film without having to need all those other people and a whole crew and kind of the hierarchical structure. So we each ended up making in our collaborative group that runs the space is a co-op of different kinds of filmmakers and artists around LA, and we've had many people who have moved away to different places, and so we actually just created a new film that's going to be a 24-minute film in our Sound We See project series. We've made these all over the world for the past 10 years, and they're always collaborative, community-built projects that are by the community, about the community, so usually it's around a city. We have made this film as kind of an exquisite corpse style, so each of us shot 1 minute of film to represent 1 hour of the day. It's being edited together right now. We actually haven't seen anything other than our own, and that'll premiere on Friday night online, and also projected out of people's windows, so that'll be kind of exciting. So yeah, just like different ways of collaborating, and that didn't have anything to do with Zoom. It was more like a chain letter that we're all going to kind of see on Friday night, so that'll be exciting.
I just wanted to chime in on that real quick. Something that we're seeing in kind of the live comedy world, you know, obviously we can't, you know, go to live comedy shows, and comedy theaters can't necessarily, you know, have audiences in their theaters right now. A lot of shows are switching to being, you know, on Twitch, Zoom, kind of various live stream formats. And something that's like, honestly, just like, you know, speaking personally, like really beautiful to see up about that is, it's really breaking down the walls of the physical need to be in a space. So for example, just like, you know, speaking about, you know, we're a bunch of natives talking about native stuff. Like I was on a really great, like a live Twitch talk show hosted by Howie Echo Hawk, who's like a Seattle based native comedian. And, you know, I was able to do that without flying to Seattle. I've been invited to do a lot of really great, just sort of like, you know, all native, you know, stand-up shows and storytelling shows over Zoom, where it's just like, you know, people based out of, you know, New Mexico or based out of, you know, San Francisco or whatever have asked me to do their shows. And I feel like that's something that has, in terms of native stuff, I think brought like the native comedy community together, just like nationally in a way that's honestly just like really cool to see. Also see a shout out for Howie in the comments. Good stuff. But yeah, I don't know. It's just, I feel like it is making kind of the native comedy community closer because we can't be in the same room.
I would love to just jump in. And so I just completed my second year of language immersion, learning the Cayuga language. And I had relocated to, I'll steal the term so-called Canada from Rue because I just really loved that he just used. I had been up in so-called Canada for the past 2 years studying, and because of the borders shutting down and this whole pandemic, I have come back across the border where I have access to my health insurance, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things that we've been using Zoom and technology for is to try and get our 8-person cohort together to continue our language learning. And this is just a side note, an anecdote, but I think because of this pandemic and because of this distance between us, you know, we're realizing like there are only 30 first language speakers left in the Cayuga language, and they're all over the age of 60. They're all on, you know, the list of folks that you don't want to have get coronavirus. And I think we realize that there is no time to wait. before we can be in a physical space again to keep learning this language and keep pushing that knowledge forward. And we're doing the best that we can to connect with them over Zoom and connect with ourselves together to continue learning. And I think before I just am kind of like, would never have imagined that it would be possible to continue learning, but we realize the responsibility to do so, you know, given the state of affairs. And it just has brought a lot of things, serious things that already existed are just kind of being magnified. So it's been great to have that technology for us to be able to connect and continue learning, Cayuga.
Absolutely. Jade, I had a question for you, and I'm glad that we got you back. The collective that you're a part of, NDN Collective, has recently made a large announcement around COVID-19 to support communities through this pandemic with $10 million. And I would love it if you could chat with us a little bit about what it's like to organize at the level that you do, and what type of feedback and responses you're getting from communities during this pandemic.
Thanks, Amelia. And sorry about that. I just was having some Wi-Fi issues, just realities of technology. Thanks for this question. And I think it actually goes back to a previous question earlier about kind of our love-hate relationships with social media and digital technology. I use tech in so many different ways. I'm also a cultural organizer and a digital organizer, and I use tech to mobilize for Indigenous rights and climate justice, which is a big bag of worms to get into when it comes to social media and how we use technology best for those purposes. It's complicated because our relationship with those technologies, with these platforms, is complex because those very platforms that we use to organize are often owned and monitored by entities or powers that we're resisting. So it's hard. Even like Action Network, you know, just kind of entered a relationship with Wells Fargo. And so a lot of organizing groups are having to reshift how they use that tool and find new ones or create new ones. So lots there. But for NDN's work, like you said, just some background on NDN Collective. We're an Indigenous-led organization that focuses primarily on building Indigenous power through philanthropy, through organizing within that sector. 0.4% of all philanthropic dollars in the United States goes to Indigenous communities. So that's a big issue when we're talking about like climate change and how Indigenous communities are key and central in mitigating or helping us adapt. We need that funding percentage to change massively if we really want to invest in real solutions. So we organize and decolonize that space, really trying to shine light on the barriers that exist in philanthropy, so that we can get funding to our communities directly, and really, slash out the old ways of gatekeeping and whatnot that is so prevalent in that world. And we also mobilize and organize and advocate. So, we have many campaigns going on, but our big campaign right now is the COVID-19 Response Project, which you mentioned is a $10 million response fund to go to Indigenous-led organizations. Just last week, we launched the COVID-19 Entrepreneurs and Artists Grant. So this is to support artists and entrepreneurs, Indigenous entrepreneurs and artists who have been impacted by the pandemic. It's a challenge. We are one of the only organizations doing grant making at that scale. And we're also new, so, you know, getting all of our parts ready for that kind of like influx of applications, of communications, it's a big undertaking. And we're a pretty small but mighty team. We're 20 people, which, you know, for an Indigenous organization, that's actually a lot. But to the scale that we're doing work and grant making, it's a lot. And yeah, we need, we're constantly updating our systems, constantly testing, constantly finding gaps and errors and challenges. But you know, social media has been our biggest way of communicating to our folks. And yeah, it's been a real lesson in how we partner with tribal communities and other Indigenous organizations to get the word out, really building like a solid network to make sure that as many people get this news, this update around our programming. But you know, yeah, it's, I think in terms of how we organize under a pandemic, it's been something we've been chatting about internally for a long time, because business as usual is kind of, not kind of, it's definitely pushing forward. I mean, the Trump agenda is just like going full-fledged right now. And so we're really battling with like, how do we organize digitally when, you know, we can't be on the streets, we can't be, you know, doing this, practicing certain tactics that we would normally be using. Of course, some people do, and they put people at risk, like what we saw, the demonstrations we saw last week. So we're really working with that challenge right now. And yeah, interesting times, very interesting times.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And we all are with you and support you, because that seems like an incredible big job that you have in, ahead of you. And we just want to send you your love, all of us here. So thank you for doing that work. I wanted to ask a question to Morningstar, because you are a performer that, you know, performs for feature films and really famous TV shows, and obviously my favorite, Red Dead Redemption 2. But also, you are really great at organizing your local performance community of amazing and holy weirdos. And I would love for you to talk about a little bit about that work of performing between those spaces.
You mean like film and music, kind of?
Yeah, and also locally? That, and also being really that center, you know, I feel like you're a real node and center of the performance community in Albuquerque, so I'd love to kind of talk about how you do that, because not everyone does that. Some people are like, I perform for these really, you know, famous TV shows, and I don't really engage in my local community, and you really are a central person in organizing and connecting with that local performance community. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that, and also maybe how that's changed and how you're kind of maintaining those connections digitally.
Sure. First off, it seems like there's some Albuquerque people here, or New Mexicans here, so hi. I'm in Albuquerque right now, and just a little history on me. So I was born in Santa Fe, grew up in Gallup, New Mexico, and then my parents divorced, and I, after grade school or like middle school, started splitting my time 50-50 between Los Angeles and New Mexico, which is like completely separate worlds. And working in the film industry in LA was very toxic, and I was cast in Drunktown's Finest and moved back to New Mexico, and my eyes were just open to the film industry here. And not only that, it was being close to the community, also the roles and such, but it was community. It was seeing all of the different tribes that are here, but also primarily Navajo, which is the one I'm closely culturally affiliated with in the way I was raised. So, and then I was working in Los Angeles on a Netflix film, and I think it was then at that moment, and that was, you know, a couple months ago, I was gone for about 5 months, and it really hit me how much I missed my community and just how much I had built. And it kind of felt like I moved to LA because that's what everyone said I should do. And, you know, that's the filmmaking move. That's what you do. And in my heart, I was like, is it though? I think where I should be is with my community. Like, I'm not trying to follow this trajectory that everyone thinks I should be on. I'm trying to build a space, not really for myself, but for especially young Indigenous people who, when we're talking about technologies, I feel like a lot of young Indigenous people think of film as like this only in Hollywood. I mean, that's what I thought about it, was like only that, it's so far away from me. How am I going to learn to use a camera, let alone get a camera? And I think for me, it's teaching people how we're talking about phones. We can shoot phone movies. We can, home studio space is really great. So I think it's just been a gradual build of realizing how important it is and seeing the impacts. I think we get very focused on a big impact, whether it's like a whole community and we can touch them, and I'm more focused on the individual. So making actual individual connection and focusing on their voice, what their concerns are, and working on bringing that. So music has turned into a bit of a way for me to creatively express myself, but also raise funds. All of the shows that I've done in Albuquerque, New Mexico have been fundraisers for various local Indigenous led organizations. And I think it's just, it makes, as a person with a lot of depression and a lot of anxiety, I think that's what kind of keeps me going, is the day-to-day impacts I can make, because especially within quarantine, I'm sure I'm not the only one who has felt extremely overwhelmed in how to keep working and how to keep creating. Some days I feel selfish for wanting to keep creating while all of these things are going on. So what I've done is, for example, I reached out to people and I said, hey, if you've done any spring cleaning, you have any jewelry, art you want to get rid of, send me photos, and then let's do a crowdfunding, like a wrap, where people can buy the items and we're going to donate all of it to the K Info Shop. And it won't be much, but grassroots organizations, especially like the K Info Shop in Window Rock, a little bit goes a really long way. So I think it's just trying to keep the momentum in quarantine, but also acknowledging that things have completely shifted. And particularly for the Navajo Nation, as we all know, we don't really know how this is going to play out quite yet. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. That brings me to my last question, actually, which you've already somewhat answered yourself, Morningstar, which is, I wanted to ask, what is keeping everybody laughing these days? If whether it's between the YouTube crafting videos, amazing beading projects I see that Eve is doing of like gaming consoles and beading amazing other like cameras and things. So between your craft making and maybe for me crying and panicking or also coding. Yes, VR headset beaded, yes. Amazing, yes. What is keeping everybody laughing and or sane? Or you can laugh while you're not sane, so maybe just leave it at what's keeping you laughing.
I just want to follow up on something that Morningstar said and then answer that question. I think that like being in Los Angeles, it definitely like, you know, makes things easier from a networking standpoint sometimes, but it's like, ultimately, like if you're good, people will come to you. And if you're good and you're making good work that's undeniable, people will come to you. So like, perfect example is, you know, a lot of us are friends with him, Sterling Harjo from the 1491s. Dude like lives in Oklahoma and he's taken over Hollywood and he's making Hollywood come to him. So it's like, you know, I think that there's, you know, it's like if you, like you could learn how to make, you could learn how to make a movie by reading a book, and you could read a book anywhere, you know. And if you make something that's good, then people will find a way to get to you. So it's like, you know, like there are benefits to living in one of the big entertainment hubs, but it's like, you know, you could make, if you have access to something, you could make a great, you know, you could make something that could screen at Sundance on your cell phone, and like, you could do that anywhere, you know? And then to answer your question of, there is this thing where it's like, I feel like specifically like among a lot of my entertainment friends, there is this pressure of like, oh, we're all under quarantine, we're all in our houses, so you better be productive. And like, you know, I feel like a lot of us see posts from friends that are like, you know, I wrote 1,000 pages of my novel this week. And, you know, I think that, like, it's okay to keep in mind that, like, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. And, like, you know, sometimes you just got to take a day and, like, hang, you know, play Quiplash with friends on Zoom. Sometimes you got to just, like, watch a bunch of Netflix shows. Sometimes you just got to, you know, curl up into a ball and listen to the new Fiona Apple album and, you know, just have a cry or whatever. And it's, like, it's just whatever works for you, you know? What's making me laugh right now is I'm fortunate in that I have a a pretty good community of people in Los Angeles who you know, I'm friends with, and we're all kind of like, you know, we're all neighbors, we all live close to each other. So a lot of us, we go on kind of like social distance friendly walks, and like, you know, we're all comedians, we're always cracking each other up. And then more specifically than that, I'm a really big fan of just like big kind of internet comedy bits that bring people together. So right now there's a, this is probably gonna be a deep cut reference, but there was a folk musician named Sufjan Stevens who in the mid 2000s said that he was going to make an album of music for every single US state. And then he gave up after 2 albums because it was too hard. And for about 5 years, I thought it would be really funny if I just got a bunch of comedians together to just finish his 50 states project with like the most thrown together music possible in like a record time. So I remember I was, the job that I was writing on kind of wrapped up due to the pandemic. And I remember driving home from it and thinking to myself, oh, this is probably the time to just organize a big crazy comedy thing. So I put a call out to Twitter and was just like, hey, I'm gonna like do this specific thing to dunk on a bunch of, on a weird folk musician. If you want to write a song about a state, you know, here's an email address, hit me up. And it's been a month. We released 26 albums last week. We're going to release another 14 albums next week. And it's just one of those things where it's like every day, you know, like I wake up in the morning, I turn on the news, watch a little bit of what's going on in the world. And then I honestly just sit down and spend 5 hours replying to emails about and like listening to like weird songs people wrote about like Rhode Island or whatever. And that, you know, it's, and I also get a lot of messages from people, like it, kind of along with their songs, that are people telling me that like, they're thanking me for creating something that's allowed them to get their mind off of the things going on in the world. So like, you know, it's for me just, you know, when in doubt, I just go to like, how can I get a bunch of people together to make a crazy thing? And that's kind of what, you know, sparks joy for me, for lack of a better term. I mean, not that I don't have a lot of, not that I haven't listened to Fiona Apple's new album 100 times over the past week, though. So, you know, there's time for that, too. We all get everything.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something about that, too. I've really been struggling with this battle of, like, being home 24/7 and the idea that you should always be productive. Like, I have been productive, but I like finally have to like slap myself and be like, you know what, you can relax too. And so for everyone listening, like do yoga, meditate, take walks, and don't feel bad about it. And don't feel bad about spending a whole day on the couch watching Netflix. Like who cares? We're all like in these spaces now that have become our homes and our offices, and it's really conflicting to your brain. Like this is my desk where I work. You can see my TV right there. So I'm like in this space all the time where I'm like, I should be working, but I'm watching TV and I feel really guilty about it. And I'm trying to like get away from that. So it's been a struggle, but I'm trying really hard and I want other people to be the same. We're just like, don't feel guilty about that. This is an unprecedented time where we're in these just, it's such a weird scenario, but we have to take care of ourselves.
Yes, to add on to that, something that has brought me a lot of joy during this time is engaging with practices that I had given up on, such as a daily yoga class. The other thing that also brings a lot of joy to me is so a few days ago I was talking with a friend of mine who works in experiential marketing, and she said to me, Asha, virtual events are here to stay, right? And I think currently we are at an inflection point where virtual events digital spaces and shared digital worlds are here to stay. And something that brings me a lot of personal joy is thinking about how do we establish our sovereignty to create and add value to these new digital worlds. And so if any of you are interested in connecting and talking more about how to use our sovereign rights as Native peoples in these new digital spaces and digital worlds, I would love to connect further.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Asha. It's just been so incredible to see everyone together. I had such an incredible time speaking with each of you for Wampum.Codes. I hope we get to do this again as a super group. I'm going to turn this over to Kat Cizek, who's going to bring in our Indigenous Screen Office delegates to start asking some other questions, and maybe I'll answer some too, or maybe I'll just hide. Okay. Thank you, Kat.
Oh, stick around, Amelia. We need you. I just wanted to introduce and welcome a very special group of respondents who are part of a delegation that were supposed to be on MIT campus this week with us in partnership with the Indigenous Screen Office of, I'm going to say this from now on, so-called Canada. This group includes Carrie and Julie, heads of delegation, and a few other people, Nyla, there's Jason, as well as Loretta. So I welcome you in, and please say hello and join in.
Yeah, and turn on your video if you don't have it on already.
Thank you. And people out there in the world, please do put your questions into the Q&A, and Claudia is going to bring those in as well.
Hi, can you hear me and maybe see me? It's Carrie Swanson from the Indigenous Screen Office. And I just wanted to say thank you from where I'm sitting in Toronto, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee, the Anishinaabe, and the Huron-Wendat. And someone put a beautiful long version of our acknowledgement on the chat. So thank you for that. And I just wanted to say thank you to the panelists and the organizers for including us in this. And I'll leave it over to my esteemed group to ask any questions and respond.
Yeah, I'll just say hi. This is Nyla Nookshook here and also talking from Toronto. And thank you so much, wonderful panelists. This was so exciting to hear what you guys are all working on. I was taking notes and just really kind of excited about the kind of ideas and conversations that you are having as you're creating new works and exploring new interactive and digital spaces. And I'm just kind of blown away and really impressed. And I have a ton of questions, but I'll kind of let the others speak first.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Who's talking? Who wants to go?
Go, Julie.
Was that you, Jason?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say thank you to Kat for kind of organizing and trying to work with such a crazy crew. Myself and Carrie have a long history of working together, and we're really excited to kind of continue the delegation and moving forward to actually get to be in MIT. We'll see if that actually happens. It has been an interesting show all the way through. I also want to say thank you for having us as respondents to your incredible dialogue. And the thing that kind of, before everybody says hello, one of the things that strikes me the most prevalent is the two different kind of conversations that are happening both north and south of Turtle Island. And so it's been really interesting to see what kinds of things are happening in the excited states of America, as my father-in-law used to call it. And I definitely am excited to kind of hear what people want to talk a little bit about. And over to you, Jason.
Thanks, Julie. Hello, everybody. Yeah, that was a really fantastic panel. Lots of different experiences and ideas coming into it. And it's great to see, even though I come from south of that border, I learned a lot about what's going on there that I haven't been familiar. I'm located in Montreal. I teach at Concordia University, and I'm the director of the Initiative for Indigenous Futures partnership grant, which among other things looks at these questions about the intersection between indigeneity and digital media, computational media, artificial intelligence, etc. So I'm interested very interested in this conversation. Thank you all very much for sharing your generous minds.
Hi, I guess that leaves me. I'm very thankful and grateful for being able to listen and hear all these brilliant speakers and all the innovative ways people have been working on digital worlds. I'm Loretta Todd, and I'm a filmmaker primarily, but I started something called the IM4 Lab, which is a immersive lab here in Vancouver. And I'm just going to do a shout out to, you know, my team that are registered for today, Colin Van Loon and Alana Vandeman Shawanda. We're also pivoting to online, and I have a lot of questions, so I'm going to let the kind of go through the circle, if you like, from when we were first kind of introduced ourselves, and then when it comes back to me, I'll have some comments and some thoughts as well. Thanks.
Nyla, I'm going to call on you. You said you had a lot of questions. You have to unmute.
Okay, there we go. My computer just chose the time right before this to freeze, but I came back as I heard Nyla. But okay, I've got questions though. I'm really excited about what you guys have been talking about, you know, bringing a native voice to the table, particularly, you know, in writers' rooms or in those kinds of spaces. As an Inuk artist and as someone who, you know, works in Toronto and is from even further north up in Nunavut, how have you guys been working to make sure that you're not the only Indigenous people in that space? And, you know, for me, and certainly working with, you know, other people that are kind of respondents with Carrie and Jason, you know, in the past, we've kind of worked on different projects that have built mentorship and kind of working on capacity building. And I'm wondering from your experiences, what, and maybe project specific instances where you guys have been working to build capacity within the projects that you've been doing.
So for me, I moved to Los Angeles in around 2010 and got really involved in sort of the Los Angeles comedy community, specifically through places like the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, kind of Second City, and kind of those places that like Saturday Night Live uses as a feeder system. And I very quickly realized as I was climbing up through the ranks at those theaters, getting on, you know, house teams, having regular shows, that I was like the only Native person getting those opportunities. And then that kind of made me realize, oh, I might be the only Native person to ever get these opportunities, not just at the moment, but like in the, you know, 20, 30, 50 year history of these theaters. So I'm also, just since I moved here, have been very involved in kind of Native Hollywood, just, you know, the kind of the group of Native filmmakers and actors that just kind of loosely do a lot of stuff here. And, you know, I saw a lot of really funny Native comedians doing a lot of great work that just weren't getting, you know, kind of a mainstream spotlight outside of kind of all Native spaces. So that basically just made me like really put my head to the ground and try to think about like, what can I do to use my position having like a foot in the door, or like, you know, being like an elder statesman in the comedy community or ever, to like boost up as many Native voices as I can. So 2 years ago, after trying to do it for a couple of years, I finally put together an all Native American comedy showcase at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, the first time they'd ever done it in their 20 year history. And I tried to basically put together just every good Native comedian and actor and writer and storyteller that I knew in Los Angeles to give them like a platform at a theater that, you know, Saturday Night Live literally uses as like a kind of a farm league. So, and it was on Columbus Day, because when else would it be? And it was called the Ghost of Christopher Columbus Theater Smudging Spectacular. And the premise was every year on Columbus Day, the ghost of Christopher Columbus rises from his grave to terrify native people. And the only thing that can scare him back to hell are jokes from native comedians. And, you know, it was a standing room only sellout, and it was a great show. And that's something that I, you know, continue to do. We did the first one in 2018. It's something that we did again in 2019, which once again was a sellout. Then we did like an all native improv show a month after that. That was, you know, once again, also a sellout. And, you know, I try to just use my position also just, you know, guesting on a lot of like popular kind of alt comedy podcasts through networks like Earwolf. Like whenever I'm invited on a podcast to speak on native issues, I always either on the show or after the show will reach out to the host and say like, hey, so like, it's cool that you had a native on the show, but it would be cool if you had more natives on the show. So then I'll, you know, put together kind of a curated list of like 3 to 5, you know, super funny native comedians, writers that I think would be like a good fit for that podcast topically. And, you know, I also just, this is, it's something that a friend of mine referred to as quiet activism. I also just, when I'm in, you know, writers' rooms for shows that are specifically kind of non-native, you know, just kind of just writing jobs, I'll always do what I can to try to cast or staff or give jobs to, or at least like put up for jobs, just like good native actors that I know. So like I was writing for like a kid's show like last year, where it was kind of, it had kind of like a summer camp vibe, and we needed actors to play summer camp, you know, campers that like looked like they were 16, but they could be like 20 if they looked young. And we were talking about casting, and I remember literally being like, hey, my friend Benny Wayne Soley is, you know, a super funny actor. He's got improv experience. He's like 22, but he looks like he's 15. He would be a good person to put up for this. And, you know, secretly he's native, but like, you know, and like he ended up not getting the job because he was like, he's like 6'2" and all the other campers were like 5'2". So it would have just like looked weird height wise, but it's still like, you know, just using my position when I have a foot in the door to like just boost people up and like lift people up and try to like, you know, when I'm positioned to like, why not, you know, that character whose like gender is, or whose ethnicity is not defined in the script, why not make him a native actor? You know, it's just being aware, you know?
And kind of, go ahead, Jade.
Oh no, you can go.
Okay.
I'll go after you.
Sounds good. So to approach your question, Nyla, I think I'm going to borrow a term from Dr. Kim Tallbear, who is just an incredible thinker and speaker, and I think Jason might have worked with her before. She uses this term, critical mass, when talking about the positions of Indigenous people, particularly in institutions, and talking and using that to kind of push back against the way that we're tokenized in institutions. It's very common for a university to say, okay, we're gonna have an Indigenous educator, which Amelia has had a specific experience with at my alma mater. But she's saying that we don't need one person, we need a community of thinkers in these institutions. And so I think it's also about when we're advocating for Indigenous voices in places, that we're not advocating for a singular voice, kind of what Joey was talking about, but we're advocating for a critical mass of Indigenous educators and students and technologists, so that it's not all that pressure just on one person to be the Indigenous voice in any given space.
Yeah, I mean, if you have one native in the room that's like, I checked a box, that's a token. If you have more natives in the room, you can have like a realistic conversation. So yeah, 100% agree. It's like the one thing better than one native expert is 5 native experts. So
I think me and Eve discovered this, right? Like one native is a token and more than one is a coven, right?
Yeah. So like, yeah. If you're watching this and you're in a position to hire a bunch of natives of various expertises, just hire all of us on the panel and you'll get a million woke points. We'll really appreciate it.
And just Jake? One example, I want to make a shameless plug for a dear friend, Chinupa Hunsko Lugar, which he has been the curator of a project called Settlement, which was supposed to take place in Plymouth this summer, Plymouth, UK, and it's kind of this idea that will, you know, kind of turn colonization on its head or settlement on its head. He was approached by the organizers of this big event that happens in the UK called the Mayflower 400, which celebrates, of course, the journey of the Mayflower, very complicated. He was approached to do a installation there, and instead of, you know, saying, okay, I'll do it, this is wonky, but I'll do it, he pushed back and said, I will do it, but I want to invite as many Indigenous peoples from Turtle Island, because the impacts of the Mayflower aren't just on me, and I can't speak to that experience. I want to include, you know, as many people from Turtle Island as possible, and that's what he did. And the project is still kind of up in the air because of COVID, of course, and we're kind of in the floaty world of, you know, plan A, plan B, plan C. But it's an amazing project that is kind of a really good example of what it's like to push back and incorporate more voices, be more inclusive to, push back against this tokenization or this pan-Indigenous thing that happens in institutions.
I can add to this. So my role in this community has kind of been to create platforms. So I have a podcast as well, the For Real podcast. And then, like I said before, I produced the Freeland Film Festival. And so in those, especially with the festival, I invite other Native people to, we have a Native music coordinator, to try to invite storytellers, musicians, dancers, that sort of thing. And so I just also want to answer this with an invitation to all of the panelists and the people listening to check out our festival. And I know that times are really tough. So if you send me a message, I can give everybody here a waiver code to submit to our festival. Like I said, we're still trying to figure out exactly how that's going to happen. But I definitely want to involve even more Native storytellers and musicians and dancers and everything to be a part of that.
Where should we go to learn more about this unfolding?
It's the Freeland Film Festival. So you can find us on Instagram, Freeland Film Fest, or you can go to my Instagram to find out everything too, which is just foreal222.
I'm just going to jump in and say that we at our peak had about 306, maybe more, participants from all around the world. And we have a lot of questions that came in. I'm going to throw to Claudia Romano, who's the producer of Open Documentary Lab and Co-Creation Studio. We're not going to get to all the questions, unfortunately, but maybe we can, if you'd like to reach out to us later on, or Amelia might handle some of the questions in the podcast. For now, Claudia,
do you want to Kat, could I respond quickly as well to that question about bringing people into the space?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, oh, quickly. So I'll just very, very quickly, at the IM4 Lab, it was designed for that very reason that was brought up, critical mass. So since it's been operational for about 2 years now, we've brought in about 150 Indigenous people into training around from introduction to 360 to introduction to AR, introduction to VR, to advanced AR, advanced VR. I think one of the biggest and challenges we have is really production funds. So it's sort of like, it mirrors a little bit of what was like when I first started out as a filmmaker. When I first started out as a filmmaker, it was all training. Oh, you just need more training and then you can make your films, even though I'd been to film school. And I know a lot of other Native people had lots of experience. So there's that kind of resistance. And that so that's one of the reasons the IM4 was created, the idea of bringing more and more people in, and that, and it's everybody. You don't have to be an art student. You don't have to be a filmmaker. If you're interested, if you're motivated, you can come into our space. And we have everywhere from teenagers to grandmothers. And that's how we've kind of tried to keep this circle expanding. And we try to work from the perspective of sort of indigenizing the governance of that space, even though we're within a university, and the Emily Carr University of Art and Design in Vancouver. But what we do is, I created this idea when I'm conceiving of the IM4 Lab, of this Council of Matriarchs. So the matriarchs are sort of the governance system, and the idea of the role and responsibility of a governance of a matriarch is to continue to keep caring for elders and children and, you know, future generations, and also work being fearless and warrior-like when we need to. So that's just sort of a quick response to creating more space. And we're kind of really challenged now because of the fact that all universities are basically having to work online. So we're coming up with some really innovative ideas about how to respond to that in a very indigenous way. So hopefully we'll be able to share some of that down the road.
Thanks, Loretta. Claudia, we have a few more minutes before we have to close off formally, but we'll try and get to one question and then say goodbye, and then maybe leave the channel open for a bit for people who want to connect more can just exchange information.
Thanks again for all the questions that everybody sent in. Like Kat said, we only have time for maybe one more, but we got a great question about co-creation from Tendesai Cromwell, who asked, how do the panelists engage in decolonized co-creative relationships with non-human entities, i.e. plants, animals, or AI?
I can jump in. And so I am currently in upstate New York on my ancestral land, but I grew up in Oklahoma and Southwest Missouri. And I kind of ended up here not wanting to go back and expose my family, and I had a friend here that I could stay with. And just kind of like speaking on something Morningstar mentioned just around this time being a time that can be triggering, especially for someone like many Indigenous people coming from a background of childhood trauma. One of the things that I did as a young person to deal with that trauma was to leave and to go outside. And in a time now when we're unable to connect with other people and not necessarily go outside, you know, what is our relationship with the world look like? What does our relationship with nature look like? And in this really odd time, I'm back on my ancestral land for the first time, and I've been going outside and I've been exploring, and I've been thinking a lot about what is this time doing to inspire me to work more with the land and my filmmaking. And all of those things are kind of like themes in a lot of work that we do. But I love this question because I've been thinking about it a lot as I'm exploring this land that I know that knows me. And how can I use this time out on this land in dealing with this kind of pandemic trauma to form a more cohesive relationship with the land? And how can I use that to influence my filmmaking and my collaborations outside of human beings? So I don't have an answer to that question other than I really appreciate it and have really been thinking about that a lot and hope to form, you know, conclusions as things move forward.
One way that
can I just jump in a little bit about the AI part of that question? Is over the last 2 years, I've been working with a group of Indigenous folks looking specifically at this question of Indigenous protocol and artificial intelligence, and really trying to think through what our relationship to that technology might be, but also sort of as a proxy for the larger question of how do we relate to technology given our different cultural knowledge frameworks and a way of approaching the question of human kin and non-human kin. You can go to indigenous-ai.net and read a little bit about us, but we're just about ready to publish a 200-page position paper that gathers together the conversation that happened between 35 of us Indigenous folks from all over the world, artists and community knowledge keepers and technologists. If you guys don't mind, I'm going to put you guys on the mailing list. We'll send out a notice. We'll send out a notice when it gets published. We're just finalizing the design now.
Yeah, that sounds so fascinating because I'm a big sci-fi reader. And what is just amazing to me is the consternation that Western writers get themselves into about whether or not AI, what rights AI might have and personhood. And I'm just so excited to see Indigenous thinkers approaching these questions, because I think that our philosophies and epistemologies are not so concerned about ranking and putting things in hierarchies based on perceived ability or intelligence. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see what y'all put together. The one thing I was going to say about the land is, you know, this is a really simple thing, but we decided to not have our summer programs for childcare this summer because of COVID-19. And usually what I'd be doing during that time is weekly or biweekly plant walks and land walks with our children. And so one way that we're kind of bridging that gap is that I'll just be getting on like Facebook Live and going through the woods and showing people various plants and telling them stories about them. So that's one small thing that our community is doing moving forward.
That's just going to jump in and say that we're running out of time here on the formal part of this call, and I'm just going to close off with a few quick thank yous, but I invite you, anybody who can stay on, please stay on for a few more minutes. We didn't get to everybody's questions, but if you email them to us, we will be sure to share them with Amelia and the panelists and ISO, and anybody who wants to answer will do their best. We just want to give a quick thank you to our partners and give shout outs to Amy Shapiro-Raykar at Mozilla, to Carrie and Julie at the heads of the delegation for the Indigenous Screen Office for this amazing partnership. And most of all, we really want to thank Amelia for your beauty, your humor, your wisdom, your everything. You're just awesome. Thank you so much. And we want to invite everybody to listen to her podcast. We're going to put her link in the chat. Watch for more wampum.codes as we, as well as the Indigenous Digital and Media Delegation with the Screen Office at the Co-Creation Studio at MIT Open Doc Lab. We're really, really honored to announce that both projects are going on through the fall of 2020. So there's going to be more of this, and we welcome, all collaborations, all co-creations, criticisms, and invitations to join the circle. Finally, I'd like to thank all our wonderful Open Doc Lab people, William Euricchio, Sarah Wallazin, Claudia Romano, and Sam Mendez. So thank you all, and be well. Stay on for a few more minutes. We can exchange more Twitter handles and contacts. This is a huge chat list. We'll try and publish it somewhere in the Open Doc world as well. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much for everyone to join. I know when we were recording our podcast, a lot of times people would say, oh, I wish I could talk to so-and-so, and I was listening to their episode, and I would love to meet them, and so I'm so glad we all got to at least meet in this weird Brady Bunch Zoom together. Thank you so much for doing yet another Zoom meeting when most of us are very, very, very tired of them and dealing with all these, you know, scrolling comments and questions. And just thank you so much for being here. I feel your presence even though you're far away. So thank you. You're welcome.
I gotta hop off, but it was so wonderful connecting with everyone. Hope we stay in touch.
Yeah.
Bye, everyone.
It's a pleasure.
So nice
to
meet you.
Thank you.
Please reach out. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much. Can't move the meeting because my cat is sitting on the keyboard.
I mean, you can't move everything.
You gotta lift up your cat and show us your cat. Come on, move the camera down. Let us see that cat.
Oh, yay. Baby! Oh yay. My god!
Now here's the part of the stream that I'm particularly excited about.
I know, we saw Rue's cat. We saw Eve's cat. My cat is literally like a foot away from me and ignoring me. She's just like. She comes on some of my webinars, and it's very great. People all cheer, but now she's ignoring me. It's okay.
But the cat suit, come on.
Yeah, that's bringing it.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I wanted to wear it for this, but Twitter gave me the extra nudge I needed to just live my truth, I guess.
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys, so much for having us.
Thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, this is an amazing